From RTE Radio 1, you're listening to Arena Encore.
As a country, we have produced great writers, far more than an island of our size should ever dare to do. And one could argue that it's the world of the short story, those spare few pages of perfect prose, which we've excelled at even more than our world-shifting novels. Everyone from William Trevor to Frank O'Connor to Claire Keegan has written the perfect short story. But today we are celebrating Mary Lavin, who wrote brilliant short stories from the 1950s and was regularly published in The New Yorker, the proceeds from which she was able to buy Muse in Dublin 4, where other writers such as John McGahern and Patrick Kavanagh would gather. So one of her most fervent champions is not a bad writer himself, Colm Tobin, who has selected his favourite stories of hers for a new collection. And Colm joins me on the line. Colm, you are very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And I heard you on with Brendan O'Connor over the weekend. Of course, you were talking about your own collection of short stories at the News from Dublin. But we're going to talk about Mary Lavin. You read her while you were still at school. What did you see in her writing that made you want to read more of her?
They were very memorable, the stories that were on, I think they were on the Intercert. There used to be a thing called the Intercert course, a story called The Widow's Son, which was a story that had two endings. And I was sort of literary, aged 14 and 15, so I went to the library in Wexford and I found other books by her and a few stories that have stayed with me really all the years, one called Happiness and the other called In the Middle of the Fields and the other called In a Café. So when I was selecting this anthology of her work, these were the three sort of flagship stories, and I built the rest of the selection around those three stories.
In the Middle of the Fields is a really powerful short story, and she writes about being a widow in that as well. So did you identify, you know, with that in some way?
Yeah, my mother was a widow, so I was interested in sort of, anyway, I saw the word widow. Oh, widow, look. And when I came to Dublin in 1972, you could see Mary Lavin around certain parts of the city. She could be in Bewley's in Grafton Street. She could be in a place called the Country Shop, which was near Baggot Street. She could be walking along Stephen's Green. She could be in Stephen's Green. She had this muse house in Lad Lane off Baggot Street. But she was usually alone. She was usually dressed in black. She had her hair back in a, she didn't do a perm or the normal hairdo that Irish women of that generation did. She had her hair back in a bun. She looked slightly distracted. I mean, the National Library, she could look especially distracted, wandering, you know, looking for books, but there was nothing distracted about her. She was very sharp. And you realise that when you read the stories, just the sheer attention to detail. I went to interview her when her selected stories came out first from Penguin in 1981. So I'm sort of 25 years old, and she's a sort of senior writer, and she has a house on a bend in the River Boyne, which she'd inherited from her husband. And she had a way of starting the conversation and then saying, now what was I talking about? And then going back to that subject and circling around, as her stories often did, until she would swoop on a conclusion. But she told me something amazing, that she had a contract with The New Yorker. But they only paid her for the stories they used. But they paid her more, above the odds. But she had to send them everything she wrote. And when she had a choice between, she would have three stories in her head. She could only write one just now. She would pick the one she thought they were least likely to use, meaning she would never write for the money or write, you know, for the market, that she had a sort of distance from that. But of course, she could be wrong. They could end up using them. And there's a marvelous new book about her relationship with her editors at The New Yorker. But in ways she wrote about her own life, mm-hmm. and in ways she dramatized it, found key moments, so that it was almost, some of it was almost fictionalized, some of it was almost very deeply connected mm-hmm. to how she lived and what preoccupied her.
You're talking about her attention to detail, and I just want to just come back to In the Middle of the Fields. And I was listening to you read her short story on the New Yorker podcast, and like you said, attention to detail. There was a bit where she talks about her husband's shoes that were in the hallway, and then you find out that her husband's name is Robert. And that to me, you know, that kind of, as you said, she swoops in and then you're like, oh, her husband's name is Robert. He wasn't mentioned thus far, you know, in the short story. And she was able to build tension. I don't know how you feel, you know, about that particular short story, but I was tense. I didn't know what was going to happen. And then what actually happened in the end wasn't what I anticipated.
Yes. It's like that thing I was talking about, that story in the middle of the fields, which is, I think, one of her masterpieces, that she, it seems to be circling around somewhere else. And then it swoops into it over another territory that she's talking about being a widow. And there are a number of things where she breaks the cliche. You know, she feels much safer in the middle, in a house in the middle of the fields than she would in a house on the edge of the road. That even though her husband is recently dead, people think she wants to talk about him. She wants people to raise the subject of him so she can sort of bring him back in her memory. But she doesn't want that. That's the last thing she needs, is to hear his name. And there are a lot of things like that in the story where you think one thing would be true and another thing is true. Mm-hmm. And then when a man comes to the door, it is too late at night. And there is an element of him intruding on her. And there is a slight element of danger, but then she swoops away from that. And then she moves into the story of his life, into the man's life. And so it is the story, a real story of an encounter, and you don't know which way it's going to go. And it's very dramatic, it's very powerful, and it seems extraordinarily real.
No, it really does. And I think that a lot of women, you know, who listen to that short story would be able to identify, you know, that fear and loss and loneliness of living in a house on your own. Well, there's three children, obviously, in that story as well, but they don't really feature, do they? They're in the background.
No, the children are upstairs in bed, so there's a whole sense of all that part of the evening is over. There's now nothing to be left except a few hours before sleep. Mm-hmm. And this disruption comes. And then you don't know which way it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. How difficult is it to write a short story? And why do you think the Irish are quite so good at them?
Well, Frank O'Connor wrote a book about it called The Lonely Voice. And I suppose he was talking about there was once an idea that there was not enough, let's say, middle class life in Dublin or in Cork. Or in Ireland. Mm. That in other words, to give a character enough chances and choices, to allow a character to face her destiny, say in Jane Austen, just go back that far, you would need a house. You would need a garden around the house. You would need parkland around the garden, and you would need many, many thousands of acres around that. And in that case, you have a settled society. Everybody knows their place in it. People have 10,000 a year. Try and bring that over to Ireland. First of all, the house, the glass would be broken. Someone would be threatening to burn it. There'd be no, the garden would be weeds, and the parkland didn't exist. And agricultural land was the most disputed, contested thing in the whole country, with the Land League and all the different evictions. So that you just couldn't get that notion of a settled world in, you know, even in Dublin. So that, you know, modernism came easy. You could write a big, untidy, massively ambitious novel such as Ulysses. But to try and write a novel about a middle-class family, such as John Galsworthy did with The Forsytes, for example, or Balzac did, or Thomas Mann did, Ireland didn't have enough, let's say, textured class life or the possibilities of people facing their destiny. So you could get a moment of pure disappointment really well in an Irish story. You could get an only child. You could get a spoiled priest. You could get a widow. You could get someone living a very isolated life. You could get the possibility of happiness and then that being thwarted. That these were the things that would almost lend themselves naturally to a place as isolated as Ireland. And indeed, you get some of the same tones in some Icelandic fiction or indeed in some Catalan fiction. The idea that adulthood is not something that, you know, that, you know, it isn't as though there could be a family, and that that some of the family would emigrate, for example, in an Irish story, and there would be the loss and loneliness of them being away. So that the idea is that then the story would lend itself to having the same sort of effect as a song. Mm-hmm. That a song could begin simply. Mm-hmm. It could look ordinary. Mm. And something would happen between the melody and the voice and the words that would lift the moment in a way that was mysterious. Mm. And that you wouldn't quite understand as you were reading. It would give you a sort of shiver, which I think is what happens in The Middle of the Fields. I think is what happens in a story like Happiness by Mary Lavin. I think it's what happens in her story In a Cafe, that there's a moment where you feel something has turned, something has shifted. And there was a theory once that this was something that the Irish experience lent itself to. I think this theory has been demolished somewhat by the arrival of John Banville, the arrival of Sally Rooney. You know, almost every novelist who writes now sets up themselves in opposition to that theory that in Ireland you can't write novels. But still, in the stories of Colin Barrett or Claire Keegan, as you said, you're still getting that idea of a single individual in a slightly remote, lonely place, feeling something or doing something or experiencing something that is mysterious, even to the reader.
Can you remember the first short story that you read, and was it Mary Lavin, actually?
I mean, there's a William Trevor short story called Access to the Children. And it's about a man who gets to bring his kids out on an outing. He's divorced. And the agreement is he can bring them out once a fortnight. But he goes into brings them into a pub because it's raining. I think that's why he brings them into a pub. But he gets drunk slowly. You watch him getting slowly drunk and begins his grievance all about his wife and all the things she's done to him. And you realize he's drinking far too much and the kids are growing wild. And of course, he's going to bring them back incredibly late. And he has messed up the whole day. And whatever way it's done, because you're in his mind all the time, there's something absolutely brilliant about it. That's one of those stories where you're watching the dilemma of somebody else as though it becomes your dilemma, and you're living in his mind as though it's you. But the story, Mary Lavin's story, Happiness, which was the title of a book of stories, is really told by her daughter. It's told by the woman's daughter. And I was in university with Mary Lavin's daughter, Caroline Walsh, who later became literary editor of the Irish Times. And it's almost written in a way that's almost uncanny in Caroline's voice, which was close in a way to her mother's voice, of just telling a story about her mother, that her mother loved the idea of happiness. She talked a lot about happiness, what happiness was, what happiness meant. And it just reminds you of a lot of people in Ireland, you know, aunts you have or grandmothers who would have a theory about some area of life, happiness. Now, I think happiness is this or that. Mm-hmm. But then you realize that there are many other things going to happen in the story. Mm-hmm. And her experience as a widow, her experience of losing her husband, that is really what everything she's saying is disguising or concealing. That there is something much deeper and darker going on in her life. And that's given away slowly in the story. The narrator is in some way both unreliable and to be trusted. And you can't judge. But you realize that the initial paragraph about happiness, her mother's view on happiness, was set up to distract you. Mm. And that's the most fascinating idea, where there is another character in the story who's the reader. And the reader's being wrong-footed and then brought into the story and then brought out again. And that's a most fascinating idea. Mm,
absolutely. And, you know, we mentioned before the fact that she hosted many great writers and others, you know, literary leanings in her Muse House near the canal in Dublin. What do you imagine those gatherings were like? Like, were they like a prison salon or something more homely, I wonder?
Well, you see, there were two sorts of gatherings going on usually on those evenings. One was a gathering of writers in MacDade's, who were drinking as much as they could, and Flann O'Brien, you know, Patrick Kavanagh, Anthony Crone, and some of the younger poets. And that would be generally male. Well, it wouldn't be all male, but it would be mainly male. And there would be no food. There'd be no food involved. There'd be no food. And there would be a lot of literary talk, but a lot of drunken literary talk. And everybody enjoyed it immensely. But the gatherings in Lad Lane were different in that they were, famously there was spaghetti bolognese, which was an unusual thing at the time. There was red wine rather than whiskey or pints of Guinness. And I suppose the talk would have been more, let's say, sober and cosmopolitan. So it would be very different. It would be a sort of salon led by Mary Lavin rather than the wit and wisdom of a Flann O'Brien or Patrick Kavanagh. So they were really, really, the two of them could be held on the same evening. One or two people could go to both, but not many.
Right. Well, I'd love to be a fly on either of those walls, do you know? And Colm, can I ask you, did she directly influence you in your writing?
Oh, yeah. She, I mean, the idea that in the city you're living in, As a student, I was 17, 18 years old. There's this woman, and you could see her, and you could read her, and you could see her new books were coming out. And that also, she was one of those writers who was always available to come to a university, you know, that she wouldn't charge a big fee or make any fuss or want expenses. You just didn't, I mean, I invited her to come to University College Dublin, and I just got a letter back saying, of course. And, and she came, and she was brilliant. And I suppose that sense of what was possible. Most writers at that time, you know, that you were reading were almost, for example, John McGahan was never in Dublin. I never saw him. There was no reading by him. There was no event where he was speaking. So that, you know, you read his books, but he was living elsewhere. Mary Lavin was very different, and she was very friendly, but there was also the sense of her absolute devotion to her work, that the books appeared. She was what Henry James calls a constant producer. And what's really great about her now is that that a lot of people in New York, in publishing and in London, had forgotten about her. And when it was drawn to their attention, there was this writer, and there were all these stories by her which were just brilliant. And she was more or less out of print. I mean, she was in print in Ireland, but not in print in other countries. And this is enormous. I mean, this book, An Arrow in Flight, the selected stories, it's everywhere you go in New York, and people are talking about it, and people are discovering her in America and in England. And the other day, I got an email from an editor in China to say, who owns the rights to those Mary Lavin stories? How could we get them in China? And so, this is just, so it's a big moment. It's a rediscovery of a very important writer.
And what do you think she'd make of it?
I think she had an idea of her own worth. I think she realized that one of the things she didn't do was she didn't write about the War of Independence or the Civil War or the sort of, the whole background of, rural violence in Ireland. That she stuck to what she knew or what she thought she could imagine well, which was a sort of middle-class Dublin and middle-class Meath. And she wrote about it with an interest not in farming systems or class systems, but the human heart, how people behave under pressure, what it's like to be alive. And I think she understood because, you see, she was terribly well-educated and well-read, meaning she'd read Chekhov, she'd read Turgenev, she had read Maupassant. She knew what would abide.
So there you go. Thank you, Cullum Tobin. And An Arrow in Flight by the great Mary Lavin, selected by Cullum Tobin, is published by Vintage Classics and features an introduction by Cullum as well. Easter makes the most important part of the calendar for the world's Christians. And Nowhere Better is the story of the crucifixion, and it's nowhere better conveyed than by history's greatest artists. Joining me now to choose some of her favourite religious paintings by geniuses such as Caravaggio, Peter Paul Rubens, and our very own Manet Gellet. I'm pronouncing that correctly, am I?
Manet Gellet,
there you go, which depicts this amazing story, is art historian Jess Fahey. Jess, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
So you've chosen four paintings which all tell the story of the days leading up to Christ's crucifixion. But before we get going, who was commissioning art which told this particular story at the time?
So there's a long tradition in, you know, the Christian world of trying to convey the passion, the story of Christ through images. So for the most part, it would be the church. And certainly from the 6th century onwards with Pope Gregory the Great, he insisted that we needed the visual arts as a Bible for the illiterate. So that could be in, you know, illuminated manuscripts, stained glass windows, fresco on a wall, various different ways. As we get further up into the Renaissance, it starts to have more, I suppose, patrons who are private patrons, have their own chapels outside of, you know, just sort of the kings and queens, but more kind of middle class people, merchant class people. So it keeps changing and growing depending on what country and what era you're looking at as to who's commissioning the works.
Okay, so let's begin with your earliest painting, and it's one by Masaccio.
Yeah, Masaccio just means clumsy Tom. So he worked with another guy called
Tom. Sounds better in Italian.
I know. This is what I always laugh about with the Italian, because it's like us saying Giono or, you know, Deco or something, but it's essentially that. So Masaccio is one of those extraordinary, almost still quite mysterious artists, because he died around 26, maybe just after turning 27. Yet everything he did was really extraordinary, particularly because he sort of spans between what we would consider the Gothic or the medieval style, which is the example that I chose for you, which is a crucifix known as the Pisa altarpiece because it was commissioned for Pisa, but it's been split up since. And in that example, the background is all gold, as we would expect from earlier artworks, which of course was to reflect light and candlelight. They also would use little stamps on it, which would have little angels or different figures that if you look closely with the candle, you'd see them more closely. So there was all this sort of tradition of having this almost nowhere land of this gold setting. But what's fascinating about Masaccio is he starts introducing perspective. He starts thinking about where the viewer is seeing the artwork from, and then he changes the figure based on that, which hadn't really happened before in the history of art. It can look a little off and a little odd today, particularly if we're not standing in front of it. We don't know exactly how this altarpiece was pieced together. We only know that Giorgio Vasari made a guess at it, and most people sort of guess it in relation to that. But one of the things I find kind of interesting about him too is that this is 1426, so it's quite early in relation to the Renaissance. But if we think about it in terms of his career, within the same year, maybe within a year and a half after, he goes from painting with this gold background to painting another crucifixion, but more of a Holy Trinity because it has God the Father and the Holy Spirit in it, in fresco rather than in tempera, which is the first one, which is where you mix the pigment with egg yolk. And that one is one of the most extraordinary paintings of the Renaissance because it looks like you're looking up at the crucifixion because it's still in situ because it's, you know, painted into the plaster of the wall. And behind it is a barrel vault that looks like you could really step into it and walk around it. So he goes from a much older traditional style, presumably because that's what the patron wanted, to within a year or so painting at this incredible, highly intellectual, mathematically worked out composition where it's single point perspective. So they work it out. So it's like if you imagine drawing on a piece of paper a tiled floor, you know, you'd angle it back, you know, we used to, we were children, to make it look like a three dimensional space. So he's doing this quite early on and such a short career. So we don't even know how much further he could have gone, but he's one of the touch points and most sort of referenced by early Renaissance artists and well up to, you know, 17th, 18th century artists too, because he was doing extraordinary things.
And we have no idea how he died.
I think he was probably plague related or something along those lines. There was a lot of kind of mysterious deaths in those days, so it's a lot of guesswork. We're mostly basing it on Giorgio Vasari, and he was a notorious liar.
Okay. So
we can't trust him always.
And where can you see that piece of work?
So the Pisa one is split up into lots of different places. So the main crucifix scene is in Naples, but the one that's, you know, integral to the wall, the fresco, is in Santa Maria Novella. So have you ever been to Florence? If you come out from the train station, which is also called Santa Maria Novella, straight across the road in there. And it's actually not a passion scene, but it's next to one of my favourite Renaissance pieces, which is the Martyrdom of St. Lawrence that was jokingly referred to as looking like a male bathhouse at the time when it was painted. It's just all these muscle men posing. So it shows you in 100 years how different it can go from the seriousness of Masaccio to this kind of more mannerist style of Bronzino, and on the one wall, which is incredible to see.
I've never been to Florence, but so many people of late have told me, so maybe this is like another sign I should go.
It's absolutely extraordinary, so much to see.
Now our next chronological painting, it's one which hangs on the wall of our National Gallery, Caravaggio's Taking of Christ from the year 1602. I remember exactly how I felt when I saw that painting for the first time. What part of the Easter story is this telling?
So essentially what we have with this moment of the Passion of Christ is the moment when he needs to be identified so he can be arrested, and the person who identifies him is Judas, who's been given the 30 pieces of silver in order to carry out this task. And he identifies him with a kiss, which makes it all the more poignant, all the more tragic, all the more upsetting. And Christ already knows it's going to happen, so he's aware of this. But what's fascinating with the Caravaggio example, particularly because we're sort of looking at, you know, Masaccio going from Gothic to Renaissance, and then I mentioned Bronzino, his mannerist. The mannerist style was so opposite to telling the story because it was more about these poses and kind of more intellectualizing than it needed to be. So then there's a pushback against that kind of art, and ultimately of the Council of Trent, who come in to speak up for the visual arts, as among other things that the protests of the Protestants were sort of speaking against within the church. So Caravaggio comes just after the Council of Trent, where they've now decided that art needs to be direct. It needs to speak to the emotions. It needs to be easy to understand. It shouldn't be in any way, sort of suggesting anything lusty or too intellectual, which they, you know, thought the Manners were doing. And that's why I think the Caravaggio is still so potent an image today, because it is so direct. He pushes all the figures up to the front of the picture plane, so they seem like they're in our space. They're pretty much life size. No details in the background. Doesn't have gold, doesn't have a barrel vault. It just has black, essentially. And the figures are almost as if it was a cropped photograph pushing out of the frame. So as you stand in front of it, you feel like you're part of this tussle as these, you know, people are pushing past Christ and he's holding firm in the center. And one of the things I often talk about, you know, when I'm teaching about art history is if you're trying to understand a painting, mimic the movements of the people in the painting. And if you look at the taking of Christ, he's got his hands clenched really painfully. And the more you do it, you can feel it in your own knuckles. You can feel the kind of that sense of that stress. And that, along with the look on his face, immediately tells you what you need to know about his emotional state. But the hands are also firm in the center, if you look at the composition, where everything else is being pushed around. So you could see it as his faith, you know, representing kind of prayer hands either. And Caravaggio is an expert at using kind of a spotlighting effect that we call chiaroscuro, which is light and shade, to highlight hands and faces, which is where you get emotional expression. The Italians in particular are famous for their hand gestures. So in one corner you have presumably St. John, because he doesn't have a beard, running out of the frame with his arms up in the air. So he's panicked. And just those little touches tell us so much about the story. But it's meant to make us feel, is the point. So it shouldn't be over intellectualized. It makes us feel we're there. And one of the things that I love about it too is that the soldier arresting Christ looks like he's dressed in 17th century clothing, which would be the equivalent of that being painted today with a Garda grabbing Christ. So it's meant to be kind of happening in your world to make it as real and, you know, potent as possible.
And is that Caravaggio in the background holding the lantern?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating one. We believe it is because it looks very like other examples of him. We know he used himself as a model, particularly in his early days in Rome. He was from near Milan, from a place called Caravaggio. His name is actually Michelangelo de Merzi, and Caravaggio was the place he was from. But when he's in Rome, he uses himself as a model. So we think that's likely him. But what's fascinating about it is that he holds up a lantern. And artists were often called some version of illuminator, so the ones who shed light on something. But in that scene, that light is not shedding light on anything. The light is the divine light, as I mentioned, highlights the parts that tell the story best. So he was very clever being able to do that. In his time, however, he was criticized for being too naturalistic, that he wasn't intellectual enough, and he actually got in a lot of trouble for kind of going a bit off script. But because he's coming so closely after the Council of Trent, in a way he has to help the church sort of figure out what they're going to do about art to make sure it's not idolatrous and to answer those protests from Martin Luther and others since.
Was there a story about that Caravaggio painting? Did it go missing?
It was found, essentially. So technically, the weird thing about it, so it was commissioned for the Mattei family somewhere around 1602, along with the Supper at Emmaus, which is in the National Gallery in London. Recently in Ulster, they had the two, so they borrowed ours and they had the other one. It was great seeing them together because they hadn't been together for years.
Wow.
So it was sold in 1802 from the Mattei family to a collector in Scotland. But we believe it was him, put on the frame that it was by Gerrit van Honthorst, who was a Dutch artist who had copied Caravaggio's style in Rome. We usually call him one of the Utrecht Caravaggisti. But his name was spelled incorrectly on the frame. So that sparked off a little bit of debate, kind of even that early on. We're kind of looking at the 19th century. Then by around 1920, I think something like that, it was purchased by an Irish paediatrician, Dr. Maria Lee Wilson, and she then gifted it to the Jesuits in Dublin because her husband had actually been killed. He was a member of the RIC in Wexford and they'd helped her. So she gifted it to them, and then in the 90s, Sergio Benedetti, who used to work for the National Gallery, was asked to go and assess it. And he looked at it and thought, I think that's Caravaggio, not Gerrit van Honthorst. And because his name is spelt wrong, might be more likely that it isn't Gerrit van Honthorst. So he did the research along with many others, who found enough evidence, things like pedimenti, which is where an artist makes a change as they're painting a work. If you're making a copy, you don't do that because you already know what the finished work looks like. So there's pedimenti. If you go and look at it in the gallery, you'll see one of the straps on the soldier in the front. You can see how it's been painted over and changed the position. And they think the canvas is the same as the one in London. So if that's real, then the other one is. So there's lots of these arguments, but it's a fascinating kind of, you know,
imagine
sort of crime solving mystery.
Yeah, imagine being the person that suddenly figures out that they have a Caravaggio in front of them.
It happens all the time with Caravaggio because he was so out of favour for such a long time. And the Baroque in general, and we sort of class that as early Baroque, kind of naturalism, sort of leading into the bigger dramatic Baroque. But that style was seen as less intellectual and kind of dismissed for a while. And we know works by Gerrit van Honthorst and Caravaggio were left in storage spaces, and they come up more often than, you know, something by a Renaissance artist might, which is
everyone should check their attics.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now let's move on to the Flemish artist Peter Paul Rubens now, and to a painting which was commissioned for the altar in Antwerp, where it still hangs. And it's only a few years after Caravaggio's. This is the Descent from the Cross. What are we looking at? Who is depicted and what is their emotional state?
So this is a prime example of the Baroque. So this is getting right into the correct sort of, you know, era for that term. And actually, Peter Paul Rubens knew the work of Caravaggio, and Rubens is a fascinating artist because if we think about Caravaggio, he would just get them, his models into the room, paint them exactly as he saw them in front of him, which at the time was considered a bad practice. Whereas Rubens would go and look at all the other artworks and make reference to a pose from a piece of antiquity or from Michelangelo or somewhere else. So he was seen as more intellectual. But the fascinating thing about Rubens is when he combines these influences, he ends up creating something uniquely his own. So in this painting, we're looking at just the central piece of a triptych. Really, it's a polyptych, multiple scenes, because the backs are painted as well. But standing in front of it, you see the three scenes. The Visitation on the left, on the right is the presentation in the temple, and in the centre is this Descent from the Cross. And the thing that's extraordinary about it is how, again, similar to Caravaggio, the intent is to move you. But the way that it moves you is through much more clever design than we would have in Caravaggio, that's just pushing that into your face. Because what Rubens does in it, he creates this sense of motion, almost kind of a slip of gravity. When you see the cross and the figures trying to hold Christ's body as they're wrapping it in the white cloth, the sort of shroud, to hand it down so that he can be buried. So in the Passion of Christ, Joseph Arimathea applies to Pontius Pilate and asks for the body. So he's allowed to take the body down. But in doing so, Rubens shows the moment of that actual act. And all you can feel in it is the weight of the body, which is both, of course, literal and also figurative, because the weight of this sacrifice. And even in it, there's really kind of interesting details where he has, for example, one of the figures who isn't identified as an individual, one of the helpers, is holding the cloth in his teeth so that he can pull up, and you see the actual true kind of physical effort it takes. And the more you think about it, Christian or not, the more you think about it, it is a tragically devastating thing to look at. The figures around, which include the Marys, you know, Mary Magdalene, Virgin Mary, and a few others, as well as St. John and also Nicodemus, all of their faces are full of the anguish, of the pain, of the sorrow. And you start to realize he was someone's friend, someone's son, you know, and all of that true kind of emotional human element comes out in it. But he does it through, as well, as I say, this sort of interesting composition where as you look at it, you almost feel like it's slipping or moving in front of you. Thankfully, it is still in situ. It's still in the church that it was intended for. So it would have been painted in the early 17th century. It was stolen by Napoleon. He brought it to Paris. He stole everything he could get his hands on, really, everything that was considered worth. While he wanted to create in Paris like a universal museum of all the best works of art, so he went around just pilfering it all. It was stolen again in 1914 during the First World War. Luckily, they got it all back and it was in okay condition. So we know exactly where it was intended for. similar to Masaccio, he would have been well able to understand the, you know, perspective worked out based on where the viewer will stand to see it. But it is quite overwhelming, one of those ones that you see it in person. There's another example, I didn't put it on my list, but by an artist called Tintoretto in Venice. And that's a crucifixion scene in the Scuola di San Rocco. Mm-hmm. And it has that similar effect that when you stand in front of it, it's overwhelming. The more you look at it, the more you feel like the figure is just going to fall onto you.
Now, I have to move on to our last painting. And it is by the great, is it Mani Gillet?
Mani Gillet.
Mani Gillet.
Yeah, her painting, Dublin. Yeah,
Mani Gillet. Yeah. Her painting is called Deposition and it hangs in the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin. Remind me who she is.
So Mani Gillet is one of the most important Irish modernists. So really, we owe a lot to her in relation to having any school of modernism, not because she was a, well, she did teach a little bit, but not because she was dictating to people what they should do. What she actually did was create a space in Dublin for non-academic artists to have support, to have places to exhibit. She was the first chair of the Irish Exhibition of Living Art. So vital and also very encouraging, particularly to other modernists. And she would send them to Paris to learn about abstraction as she had studied along with Evie Hone under people like André Lahoute and Albert Glaze. But in this particular work, what's fascinating is it's almost like her further on phase. So if you think about her going through the academic tradition, learning the typical or proper way to paint as people would consider it, then she goes to London and she loosens up her style a little, more modern, goes to Paris and eventually becomes pure abstract. So no identification of a figure, just shapes. And this fascinates her as a kind of eternity symbol. And then she translates that in the 1930s after going to see Chinese art into a mixture of the figurative and the abstract to create emotional content with colour and form alone.
You're listening to Arena Encore. You can listen to Arena every weeknight from 7 on RTE Radio 1 and the RTE Radio Player app.
Very excited because I have Sinead Gleeson and I have Katrina Crowe in studio and we're going to talk all things John McGahern. I believe Pat Collins is on the phone as well, so this is very exciting because 20 years ago today, Ireland lost one of its most profound, exacting and quietly revolutionary literary voices, John McGahern. He was a writer who proved that you do not need a sprawling global canvas to capture the human condition. Instead, he found the entire universe in the small things, the muddy boreens, the shifting seasons and the quiet, claustrophobic farmhouses of Leitrim and Roscommon. McGahern said that the universal is the local, but with the walls taken away. And through his mastery of both the novel and the short story, he dismantled those walls for readers around the world. He never wasted a single word, paring back his language until only the absolute undeniable truth remained, and that truth was often hard-won and deeply personal. His work is haunted by the defining traumas of his own life, the devastating loss of his beloved mother when he was just a child, and the overbearing, often brutal presence of his autocratic father. Yet, through his art, McGahern transformed his own private grief and familial scars into something universal, holding up a mirror to the silent oppression of 20th century Ireland. And his masterpieces, of course, have transcended the page. Works like Amongst Women and his final novel, That They May Face the Rising Sun, have both been beautifully adapted for the screen, introducing his sour patriarchs and gentle lakeside communities to entirely new audiences. So joining me, as I mentioned, now to discuss his work and his legacy are historian Katrina Crowe, writer and editor Sinead Gleeson and filmmaker Pat Collins. It's lovely to have you.
Thank you.
Katrina Crowe, if I could start with you, how did you come to John McGahern's work? Which were the first works that you read and where did they lead you?
Well, I read The Barracks not that long after it came out, I suppose, in the early 1970s. And I found it very grim and dark. I mean, when I went back and looked at it years later, I found it really interesting as a kind of source for social history because it gave us a lot of information about what life was like in the late 40s, early 50s in Ireland. I let him alone until Amongst Women in 1990, which was stunning and a sort of iconic portrait of a patriarch in a family surrounded by women who have to do what they are told, but also a really important portrait of anti-treaty disillusionment at the birth of the new state and the violence that was needed, or so it was thought, to achieve that and the disappointing results. So you've got all of that. It's he's not a political writer, but because of his father's connection with the nationalist struggle, that comes in all the time. This dissatisfied man who can't be pleased, who fears that, and it's not because he fears the Republic was betrayed. It's about pride and personal animus rather than anything else. That's a really interesting thing to see happening in fiction at that point, because there was nobody else really doing it. And of course, it's a sort of a primer for what happened to women under independence, the fact that their dreams and their rights and their responsibilities were repressed and suppressed by the state. And he never preaches, but he makes it very clear through the characters that he writes that there's something funny going on.
Okay, Sinéad Gleeson, now coming to you on that same note, how did you first come to his work and what were your earliest impressions of McGahern? Because he was quite groundbreaking in what he wrote about, wasn't he? Parental and clerical abuse, for example, and it cost him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I read Amongst Women and then worked my way backwards. And I think that is his landmark novel. And I think it's interesting in that it's very much a state of the nation novel where not much of the state is mentioned. It's the universe in microcosm is the farm, the field, the boreen, as Katrina says. And I think that what I think about the work when I think about it is the specificity. It is about the family. It is about the land. It is about the places and the relationships. And I think that when I was reading it, I was very glad that I was born outside of that Irish time, that I didn't grow up in a time like that. And yet we're all still feeling the legacy of that time very much. But I remember reading, if you take something like The Dark, which opens with, I think it was Carlo Gebler said it's one of the most violent scenes in the whole of Irish literature, where it's a father who's threatening to hurt his son and hurt him in front of another child as a witness, and then doesn't actually do it, but the damage is done and there's urination and all sorts of things. It's still really difficult to read, in the same way that Amongst Women is very difficult to read because of this paralysing and claustrophobic hold that this one patriarch has on the people around him, who mostly happen to be women. So it's interesting to read it because you learn a lot about contemporary Ireland, I think, by reading about McGahern and the foundations of what happened.
Mm-hmm. And Katrina, when we talk about McGahern, there is a universality to his work. What is it like to read his work as someone who actually knew him, having spent evenings with him and his wife, Madeline, at their farm in Leitrim?
Well, I didn't know him until the 1990s. I met him through Colm Tobin, my friend, and we used to go and visit them in their beautiful cottage in Leitrim. Madeline was extremely hospitable, a wonderful cook and a very talented photographer. And we'd eat a gorgeous dinner with a lot of very good red wine and sit up blathering until all hours of the night. John was a tremendous gossip and very, very funny. And Colm was the same. So, I mean, I would sit there and listen to the two of them. They were also both very well read and had their favourite authors from all time, as it were. John was harder on his contemporaries than Colm was, which was interesting. Mm-hmm. He was very strict about what good writing might or might not be. But it was always immensely enjoyable. And we would go for a walk around the lake the next day before we departed. And I began to understand what a grip that very beautiful landscape had. Leitrim is very calm and flat compared to other parts of the country. There are lovely drumlins and so on, but the lakes are utterly stunning, and you've got these beautiful trees all around the lake and birdsong going on.
I want to bring Pat Collins in here now, because you made the beautiful documentary John McGahern, A Private World, in 2005, around the time that he published his final book, memoir. What was it like to work so closely on that project with a man who was famously private?
Myself and Philip King, the producer, we met John in a hotel in Dublin, and about the idea of making a documentary. And he was in the middle of writing his memoirs at the time, and they hadn't been published yet. And I think I was expecting, you know, that he wouldn't be as open as he was to it. But I think it was because he was writing his memoirs at the time that he was in that kind of zone, I think. And I remember, like, over that lunch, you know, he kind of spoke the first paragraph of the memoir and the last paragraph, and it was almost like the beginning of the documentary and the end of the documentary that he was almost giving us. And And I think he was very, you know, collaborative in that way, I suppose, that he had a good sense of what the documentary might be or needed to be. Like, for instance, I suggested a couple of names of people who might talk about his work in the documentary. And he said, I think you'll find that I'll have enough to say myself, you know, rather than kind of getting experts talking about his work. And so, I mean, I would be open enough to realize that what he's saying really is that, you know, that he's up for making this documentary, and he's going to give it as much as that's needed, you know, and it won't be a struggle, in that he's going to be working with us on it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I suppose you have to kind of listen to the person you're making the documentary about, and of course John was, I mean, he was incredible, just to kind of spend time with in relation to, and just interviewing him about his work, but also, you know, his lunches, as Katrina said, you know, he had opinions on every writer in Ireland, and it was always entertaining, you know. And mm-hmm. And he was great company and a good guide, I think, as well, you mm-hmm. know. And, well,
Do you know what? Let's hear McGarhan read a passage from his final novel, That They May Face the Rising Sun. And this comes from Pat Collins' documentary, John McGarhan, A Private World.
The shore was dry, the fallen leaves rustling against his trend. Not until he reached the alder at the gate did he see the Mercedes stationed in front of the porch. Once he entered the house, he could hear his uncle chatting happily with Kate. Will he be able for it, Kate? That's the six marker. They were discussing the sale and transfer of the business. As he listened to the two voices he was so attached to and thought back to the afternoon, the striking of the clocks, the easy, pleasant company, the walk around the shore, with a rush of feeling, he felt that this must be happiness.
And Katrina, he said...
As soon as the thought came to him, he fought it back, blaming the whiskey. The very idea was as dangerous as presumptive speech. Happiness could not be sought or worried into being or even fully grasped. It should be allowed its own slow pace so that it passes unnoticed if it ever comes at all.
Sorry now for jumping in there too early, Katrina. He settled back in Leitrim ultimately, and he was content living there. What was it about Leitrim? And I know you've described the lakes and whatnot and the landscape that drew him back. And why was it so important to him imaginatively?
I really believe that his mother's death when he was 10 years old was the defining event of his life. And it happened in Leitrim. I think people are often drawn back to places that matter to them when they're children, particularly if they're beautiful places, as this is. But also, he had very interesting ideas on ideas of society and the family. And basically, he said every household or family was an independent republic with its own rules and rulers. No one else ever said that in that kind of way, but he genuinely believed it. That the place where most of the important transactions took place between human beings was in the family. Mm-hmm. And that was available to him, if you like, in that small community around the lake. The trick is, I suppose, to make the characters as specific and authentic as possible while embodying some kind of universal values. And it's a very limited world, remember. That's an important thing to remember about McGarhan. It's not a big world. Mm-hmm. It's very, very small. And you can operate in different ways within a small world like mm-hmm. that.
And Pat, let's talk about filming in Leitrim for your projects. From a visual perspective, you know, what was it about that specific landscape that was so vital to his worldview?
Well, I think he talks about the quality of the seeing is as important as the theme or the place. And I think I've discovered that with somebody like, say, Tim Robinson and Connemara as well. You know, that in certain writers, they might write about a place, but if they ended up living elsewhere, they would have written about that place as well. And I think it's that quality of the seeing what's in front of you and engaging fully with it and being accurate about it mm-hmm. and getting your sentences right. I think that's what was the thing that was concerning him. Now, he was obviously very familiar with that whole world of Leitrim, and he'd gone up close by, and he'd come back, and he'd spent, by the time I met him, he'd been living back there for 30 years, himself and Madeline. But I mean, they had lived out in Cleggan as well, and I think it was Madeline actually that really took a shine to Leitrim, I think. And then because she liked it, I think he was probably, delighted that she did like it. But if she had wanted to settle somewhere else, he'd have gone there, I think he had a good enough sense in that regard. I think, but Leitrim was important in his writing, the laneways. But I think if he ended up in West Cork, he could have written about West Cork equally as beautifully. But it's just that he was accurate about the laneways and the nature. And I think it's just the listening and the paying attention, mm-hmm. and the observation. I think that's so accurate.
What do we know about how people around him felt about having this great novelist in their midst?
Well, I think like in lots of parts of rural Ireland, I don't think they would have cared that much, I suppose, really. I mean, it's, I don't think he spoke about his writing at all, I think, or very, very little anyway, to kind of neighbours. And, I think he said, I think in the documentary, he says they take you for who you are as opposed to who you think you are, Mm-hmm. And I think they didn't really, I don't think John kind of, really, courted attention in that kind of a way, or he didn't see himself as any different to anybody else or any of his neighbours. Now, he, a lot of people kind of say, oh, he was a farmer who wrote, but like he was very adamant, that he was a writer who happened to have a farm. That was, mm-hmm. he was a writer true and true, and the farming suited him, I think, mm-hmm. And he could go to the mart and he could go into town on a Wednesday or a Thursday with his neighbours, and he could live that life. But then again, he was very dedicated, wrote every single day, for a couple of hours every morning, and thought about it for the rest of the time, mm-hmm.
And Katrina, what would your take on that be, for him, someone who was setting his novels locally and taking someone's inspiration for what was kind of happening around him?
On how his neighbours thought about it? I don't know. I mean, I didn't talk to his neighbours, so I don't really know what they may have thought. But he certainly felt very much part of his community, that he would go to Mohill, as he called it. We would say Mohill, and go to the pub on market day. And he kept cattle, of course, so he was a part of the general farming community there. He was an incredibly courteous person. So I would say he got on extremely well with his neighbours, and I'm sure they all liked him greatly. I just can't answer the question, mm-hmm. in a straightforward way. But he seemed, I have to say, very happy there. And if indeed happiness can ever be achieved, as he just told us so eloquently in that clip you played.
Sinead, I want to talk to you about his depiction of male friendship, which is kind of the key ingredient of his final novel, That They May Face the Rising Sun. Yeah. It's a dynamic rarely shown with kind of such tenderness in Irish writing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think maybe that links into the question about the neighbours, because this is the closest I think he came to putting the people who lived around him in the books, and it just so happens that they're all men. I mean, there's a beautiful line by Jamesy in that film where he says, "I've never ever moved from here, but I know the whole world," which I think it literally sums up the way McGahern approached the writing. I think that like so much of the film, Pat's beautiful film, really portrays that about the kind of the loneliness of those men, the men who've had things like, the you can't drive to the pub, where the pubs aren't there anymore. There's a certain kind of insularity and a sort of, I think at all of McGahern, there's a failure of communication, people failing to say what they think, what they mean, or asking for what they really want. And I think that's very evident in those male friendships in that book. But there's also lovely lines, very Bucketian, "Have you any news?" "No news." "Came looking for news." "Well, you came to the wrong place for news." So things like this, which is just everybody wanting to know what's going on. But they're very small, fragile relationships, but they're tender too. And mm-hmm. I think that comes across in that book particularly.
Katrina, John McGahern died in 2006, and it's 65 years since The Barracks was published, and it feels like we live in a very, very different country to the one he wrote about. What perspective does the passage of time give us on his work?
Well, as Sinead said earlier, thank God it's a different world.
I know.
We're all very glad we're not living in that world any longer, and that's no disrespect to the beauty of the books. It's a self-contained body of work. You know, it's six novels and I think three books of short stories and one major drama that really was a very powerful piece of work when it appeared on a stage. Some very interesting essays. One I remember when Colm and I went to visit him once. He gave him a document to take away with him as we were leaving. And we went back to Dublin, sat in whatever bar we landed up in and read it. And it was for Soho Square in 1993, that journal of literature that Colm was editing at the time. And it was John's reflections on the Catholic Church, where he praised the ritual, the beauty, the scent, the colour, all the regular things that people think are good about the Catholic Church, without necessarily saying, I'm a Catholic. It wasn't. But it was an interesting moment of watching his ambiguity about this major part of the world that he lived in. Now, since those years, the Catholic Church has effectively collapsed in this country because of the scandals about institutions mm-hmm. and clerical abuse. So it is a very different world. In a way, part of it would be we're looking back at a world trapped in amber that gives us something very pure and very coherent from a lost world now, a world that is genuinely gone. Mm. And that makes it incredibly valuable.
And I want to bring in Amongst Women. And Sinead, you recently wrote a new foreword for a new edition of Amongst Women. What was it like to reread that novel in the present day? And same kind of question, how does returning to that era help us understand contemporary Ireland? I watched a couple of episodes of Amongst Women, the TV show, you know. I think, did it come out in 2006?
Yeah,
and
ago.
You know, that idea of the man bringing all the kids to mass on a Sunday and everyone looking, you know, prim and proper, the pillar of society, and then him being the way he was at home with them.
The street devil, house angel.
Yeah.
John himself said about that he thought that Irish houses were, the power in the Irish houses was really with the mammy and the kind of the matriarch figures. And yet this book, he said, is a book, it's about power. It's about the fact that one man who had power in his previous roles, in his, you know, War of Independence roles, in his role in the Guard, in his role as the kind of patriarch, and sees with his health declining and everybody becoming independent and not, you know, you can't take the belt out of them, don't have to listen to him anymore. So it's very kind of stultifying in one way. And I think that, so when I was reading it, it's a very claustrophobic book. Most things happen in the house, in the rooms. Sometimes as people get out, and a car represents, you know, the mobile location of sin, but also getting out of the house. So it's very claustrophobic. It's actually very infuriating. I found myself, what runs through the book is hypervigilance, because there's so much violence in it, or everybody's afraid of putting a foot wrong, saying the wrong thing, or getting a beating. And so when you're reading it, you feel that it transfers onto the reader, that sense that I'm worried for these characters and I feel for those characters. So I felt both kind of anxious but also terrified, and but moreover relieved that kind of tyrannical behaviour for the most part is not the standard, it's the exception.
No. Let's have a listen to a clip from Amongst Women in the scene from the 1998 TV adaptation of Amongst Women, the late Tony Doyle, as Maureen has harsh words for his daughter Maggie, played by Susan Lynch, as she gives him his dinner.
Did these chops come from Cavanaugh's?
Yes, Daddy.
Nothing but bone and gristle.
Kevin said they were the best in the place.
Well, if that's what he said, we'll see that gentleman together in the morning. He's unfit for pigs. Wrap them up. What are you waiting for?
I was going to go to Kevin's, but Casey's was nearer. I thought the chops looked just as good. I thought we could save some money.
Haven't I said, time in and time out, never to buy lamb chops anywhere but from Cavanaugh's?
Yes, Daddy.
Not even simple things are made clear in this house. Everything has to be drummed in 100 times. If simple things can't be made clear, how's a person to get from one day to the next? Dumb animal. I'd be better at the running of this house. God, oh God, oh God! What have I done to deserve such a crowd?
Yeah, it's tough to listen to, isn't it? Pat, I want to go back to you. McGahern's understanding of the relationship between the writer and the reader was that it was the reader who completes the work, and he says that in your documentary. What's your understanding of what he meant by that?
Well, I think he would have believed, I suppose, that the best writing is suggestion, I think. And I think if you're suggesting something, I think you then, you know, somebody else has to actually complete that. And so I think he said all of the worst writing is statement, I think. And so I think by its nature, if it's suggestion, then I think it's you kind of have to meet it halfway. And it's, I think that's true of a lot of filmmakers and writers kind of believe that, you know, that it's in a way it's kind of two-way transmission. I think if you give too much, I think, or too much information, or if you give, or if there's no mystery there, or if there's nothing there for the reader to complete, then you're just kind of entertaining, and that's kind of, it's like, you know, too much sweet stuff, really. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of not it's not nourishing after a while. And I think it's better, I think it's just better when the reader has to do a little bit of work to complete it. And I think that's very much true. I think it's very true in That They May Face the Rising Sun in particular. And but even in his collected short stories as well, I think it's very evident. And across all his work, really, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, play another clip now. McGahern, he was a great critic and he wrote many essays on literature. And he had many opinions about what made good writing, as he discusses here.
I don't think the novel is completed by the writer, that it's completed by the reader. And I think in that sense that all good writing is suggestion, and that nearly all bad writing is statement. Well, of course, the writer is present in the work because personality, which is called style in writing, is the most important thing in any work. But I like Flaubert's definition of how that should be done, where he says that the writer should be present everywhere, but nowhere visible, like God in nature.
What do you make of that?
I think he's exactly right. And I think that the thing, there's something very unvarnished about a lot of the prose, which is, I think, is why people respond to it, even though, because it's deceptive, it's talking about very big things. And I think that one thing that McGahern does brilliantly is time. And it's very hard to figure out how he's doing it on the page, particularly in the short stories. I'm not a filmmaker, but Pat is. But I think there's something very filmic, the way he edits and cuts between time. And you see this specifically in the short stories. I included one in an anthology, and it's just, they're all like scenes, and the chronology is all out of place. It's very difficult to do on the page, but you get the point of it, and you realise why he's told the story in that way. But ultimately, like a film editor, there's something very, very visual. I think all of his work is extremely visual. You imagine yourself in those green lanes. You imagine yourself walking around those lakes. You feel it with them. And that's, I mean, that's the power of his language.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I have to say as well, too, to Pat, I went to see That They May Face the Rising Sun in the cinema, and it stayed with me. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, it was so quiet and it was so beautiful. And I mean that in the best way. And there's one scene, there's one scene in it, and I still think about it. And it's a scene, and I don't think I'm giving any spoilers away. They're dressing a body.
Oh, yeah.
For mm-hmm. a wake. Yeah. And I'd never seen anything like that depicted on screen before, me personally. And I just thought,
yeah,
it stayed with me. It was absolutely stunning. And it just like the book,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
No, it's okay. Thanks for the compliment.
You're welcome. Yeah. Now, finally, I'd like to ask all three of you, and I know this is going to be really hard, but which is your favourite work of John McGahern's, and why does it stay with you? Katrina, I'll start with you.
Well, I love That They May Face the Rising Sun for some of the reasons you've just outlined. That scene is the labourer from Dagenham, the Ford factory in Dagenham, who's come home, as he does every year, and happens to die at home.
Johnny.
Yeah. So to me, that when I read the book, that stayed with me. And I was very glad it was included in the film, because it's hugely important. To me, John is really a compassionate realist. That's what he is. He's never sentimental about people's affections or hardships or trials. He observes them with a sort of fond affection that he can transmit to the reader. And that works so well in that particular scene. But all of That They May Face the Rising Sun comes from a position of contentment to observe, to take in what's around and to be grateful for it. And it's a remarkably soothing book after the Sturm und Drang of amongst women that, that was so eloquently described by Sinead there, the violence and the misery there. We don't get that. We've got a central character who is content. And I hope that that was John himself at the end of his life.
Sinead?
I'm probably going to have to go with them amongst women because it's just, it's such a powerful book for all the reasons we've outlined, but also on that sense of, you know, parochial begrudgery and not wanting people to do well. And there is one image in the book, which I think is probably the most powerful image that John has ever written ever to me, which is he has the whole family out kind of cutting the hay and there's a pheasant in the grass that's unseen and the legs are cut from under it, which is, you know, obviously a massive metaphor and symbol for this, this man who's, who's paralyzed and this stasis that's going on in this household that everyone is sort of, you know, around this figure who can't move and is then ultimately sort of damaged. But I shudder every time I read that line. It's just, and it stays with me every time I think about the book. But there's plenty of those images in all of the work. So read them all, but maybe start with Amongst Women.
And Pat, I mean, is there any point in asking you, or do you have a secret a secret favourite?
Well, I think I said to him at the time when we were making the documentary that my two favourite books was the collected short stories, the three books of short stories together, and That They May Face the Rising Sun. And I think there's just a huge power in the collected short stories. And I think they cover such a kind of, they cover such ground, I think. But I would have to say that Rising Sun, it was kind of uncanny, I think, when I read it first, and that was before I met him. And it was just, I think the characters, I think what's great about that book is, as Katrina said, it's he's coming to a certain kind of peace with Ireland in some ways, and with the community that he grew up amongst. And I think that I think it captures the complexity of the small place and small rural Ireland in all its kind of diversity as well. You know, that it was the small place was very diverse in its own way and very complex. But I think he was able to see that and some of Rising Sun is brutal as well. I mean, really very brutal. But I think there's some of the passages, especially with Jamesy, I think are kind of some of the best passages. I think that he's one of the best characters in Irish novels, I think. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Now, my thanks to Sinead Gleeson, Katrina Crowe and Pat Collins. Pat Collins' feature adaptation of That They May Face the Rising Sun is available to rent or buy through On Demand across most platforms. And John McGahern, A Private Life, is available to rent via Vimeo. And Faber will reissue many of McGahern's most beloved works, including Amongst Women, with Sinead's introduction later this year to mark his 20th anniversary. This year marks a major milestone for Wexford Festival Opera as it celebrates its 75th anniversary. The season features three operas at the Opera House stage, three newly commissioned works and an expanded programme from the acclaimed Wexford Factory. The Festival's Development Academy for Emerging Singers, Repetiteurs and Stage Managers. It's also the first season for the festival's new executive director, Suzanne Nance. And I'm delighted to welcome Suzanne into Studio One here in RTE today, along with Wexford Factory alumni, soprano Maria Matthews and pianist Aoife Mourn. It's really nice to have you here. Maria, I'm going to start with you. Tell us about the factory at Wexford Festival Opera. It has propelled dozens of artists towards major careers. Tell us about your own journey from the factory. Where has it taken you?
Yes, so I started in the factory in 2024. I was 2024-2025 young artist. And I think for me, the thing that I gained the most from the factory is confidence and self-belief and the knowledge of how an opera house works and how to work under pressure and how to work with a big workload as well. So sort of vocal management and how to manage your vocal load to make sure you're staying very healthy.
Vanifa, you were also a member of the Factory Programme for Young Artists at Wexford Festival Opera back in 23. What doors did it open for you?
It gave me a lot of opportunities because at that stage I hadn't worked as a repetitor in Ireland yet. So it kind of opened that doorway to working in Ireland, and now I've been working with most opera companies in Ireland, and it gave me that step in, and it also gave me the opportunity, especially to work, for me, I worked a lot on Italian opera, and to kind of dive into that world even more with a lot of Italian artists as well. So I really got to the root of what that
was. Yeah, which is amazing, because you're both going to perform for us now. Tell us about the first song. It's an aria from Bellini's opera.
Yes, so this is Qui la voce from Bellini's opera I Puritani. In this aria, Elvira is singing to her love, who she thinks has abandoned her, unfortunately, called Arturo. And she sings about wanting him to come back and her desire for him to be with her.
Essa piange di sospiro.
was absolutely stunning. That was Bellini's Quella Voce. I want to ask you, Maria, what are some of your favourite roles to play in opera?
I quite like a comedic role. Yeah, I find them quite fun. I've been very, very, very fortunate with my roles in Wexford as factory artist. Actually, the first role that I got to do there was Nedda in Pagliacci, and it had been on my list of dream roles since I was about 21. So it was the first opera role that I ever learned and performed in full with orchestra. So honestly, it was a dream come true, and what a way to start my factory experience.
Is there one part that you long to play someday that you haven't yet?
I would love to play Norma in Norma by Bellini. Yes, mm-hmm. I quite like the Bellini, the music. He writes so well for the voice. The bel canto style is just natural for the singer, especially in the Italian language. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to play that.
Aoife, I have to ask you as well. You're talking about repetiteurs. What is the difference between someone who plays the piano and someone who's repetiteur?
The main difference is that I'm specialising in working with opera as an opera repetiteur, and the repertoire I'm playing is not originally written for piano. It's written for orchestra, and someone's written a reduced version that I can play in rehearsals. So I have to think like an orchestra. I'm thinking, like, when I'm playing my left hand, I'm thinking this needs to sound like a double bass, so how would they play? How would the strings shape this? So I'm in the mind of how an orchestra would play. And I'm also listening to the singers a lot more, because part of the job is also to coach the singers and to help them with various different things, musical aspects, language, whatever I feel needs help. So I have to always have an ear out for them as well when I'm playing.
Aoife, Maria, thank you so much for joining me today. And we'll hear some more music from you guys a little later on. I'm also joined in studio today by the new Executive Director of Wexford Festival Opera, Suzanne Nance. Congratulations, Suzanne. You took up the role at the beginning of the year. How are you finding it so far?
I am loving it. I'm in love with Wexford and, of course, this incredible festival, Wexford Festival Opera.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about Wexford that is so different to other festivals?
I think it's the DNA of the festival. It was founded in 1951 by a group of friends who loved listening to records. And they started dreaming big and decided to start an arts and music festival. There's a little more that went on to get to that point, but they did. And the entire town wrapped their arms around it, and they've made it happen over 75 years. So the spirit of the festival was born in 1951 against all odds to start an opera festival in Wexford so many years ago. And that continued, that sort of pioneering spirit, that trailblazing spirit to continue to do new things and bring great art to Ireland and to create it in Ireland.
And you have spent the last 8 years as president and CEO of the Global Media Arts Network, All Classical Radio, based in Portland, Oregon. So how challenging has it been for you, both moving country and job? Yeah.
Well, I'm very lucky that my husband's Irish. He is at University College Dublin, and he's the artistic director of the Choral Scholars. So when I was on the west coast of the United States, I got a call, would you interview this Irish composer who has a new CD out? That's how we met. And I have to say, we went back and forth for 10 years. And
you went back and forth between America and Ireland for 10 years.
Yeah, the
that's
west coast
love.
To here. That's love. That's love. But I think it's been very helpful because, you know, moving into this role, Wexford Festival Opera is such an important institution. It's a cultural icon, really, and it's globally known. And I feel a great deal of responsibility to shepherd it and to amplify it to the world. Having, you know, the relationship with my husband and having the insight into the Irish cultural heritage has been profound for me, and it's helped my learning curve. For me, running an arts network, much like what you do here at RTE, it's about providing access. And that's what we're all about at Wexford Festival Opera. So it's been a big change, but the change has been really sort of buoyed by the similarities in what we do and how we love this great art and want to share it with the world.
Now, there's also a theme at Wexford. What is this year's theme?
Yes, the best of. One for the head, one for the heart, and one for the funny bone. And, you know, Rosetta Cookie has woven together this tapestry of opera. There will be more than 70 events this year at the 75th anniversary. And you'll get a little bit of that. You know, what's going to move the heart? What's going to challenge your mind? And then what is going to just make you have an incredible laugh and have a wonderful time?
Recently, Timothy Chalamet, his comments about ballet and opera. How do you feel about that?
Do you know, I actually feel quite sorry for Timothy, to be honest, because number one, I think he's missing out. But number two, I think the fact is what we do is so spectacular. It is storytelling times a thousand, right? It's theater just like amplified. And what we do on the opera stage is it's so special. It's so important. We can't just say it, Kira. We've got to sing it over a full orchestra without a microphone. So I think the magic of the opera is so extraordinary. And I really hope that Timothy can experience that. And actually, he should. We've all been inviting Timothy. Yes, Timothy, come. But more than that, I think his comments actually illuminated our field. Absolutely. And I'm very grateful in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. The community opera is a growing element of the Wexford one. Tell me a little bit about that.
The community opera this year is a world premiere by Eilish Nareen, who's creating an opera installation. And the community opera continues to grow and grow, that whole program which Rosetta has embraced fully. So you'll have, you know, townspeople singing in the opera, and they're fabulous. So the community opera program is really special. It's really important to what we do and who we are at Wexford.
You're new in the position, but I imagine that you've got lots of plans and ideas for the next couple of years at Wexford. Can you share any wish list items that you might be interested in?
For me, it's about setting the stage for the next 75. We've been trailblazers for the past 7+ decades, and now it's time to remind the world. I think what's beautiful for me is coming in and having that big bright light focused on the opera and on Wexford. I think what you can expect is to see how Wexford plays a role in our brand, how important that town is to who we are as an opera festival, and I can't wait to sort of just turn up the light and the sound on Wexford and Wexford Festival Opera.
Oh, look, it sounds like it's going to be an epic 75th season in Wexford, and we wish you luck in your new position as Executive Director. And now we'll have some more music from Maria and Aoife. Maria, can you introduce your second song for us, please?
Yes, so this is Ch'il bel sogno from Puccini's La Rondine, which translates to A Beautiful Dream.
Oh,
That was Kiel Belsogno from Puccini's opera Le Rondine, sung by Maria Matthews and accompanied by repetiteur Aoife Morin. And my thanks to Maria, Aoife and Executive Director at Wexford Festival Opera, Suzanne Nance. And priority booking for the 75th anniversary at Wexford opens on April 22nd for Friends of the Festival, and general booking opens on May 6th. Further details at wexfordfestival.com.
From RTE Radio 1, you're listening to Arena Encore.